Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Ever been to a haunted house? If you have, our guest a little bit later in this program probably had something to do with that. We'll talk with him in just a couple of moments. But first, just about everyone knows the story of David and Goliath. The young David, the future king of Israel, slew the giant warrior as told in one of the Bible's most famous stories. While that encounter is well known, the full story of David is less so. There are many gaps in what the Bible and history tell us. In her latest novel, The Secret Chord, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Geraldine Brooks fleshes out his story. Geraldine Brooks joins me in studio to talk about The Secret Chord and, of course, David. Geraldine Brooks, so nice to have you with us.
It's wonderful to be here in sunny St. Louis.
Yes. Well, we certainly enjoy the sun while we can get it. Winter is approaching. No, I enjoyed your book very much, by the way. Congratulations. Obviously, a tremendous amount of work went into putting this together. But I have to tell you, I didn't like David very much. How did you come to feel about him after doing all this work on his story?
I think what is so intriguing about him and what drew me to him initially, and I still feel this way, having lived with him now for several years, as you might say, he is so complex. He really embodies the best and worst characteristics that we might find in our own heart. There's something incredibly powerful about the poetry. He wrote the Psalms that we still turn to express grief and when we're lost and seeking. We know he's a wonderful musician. We can identify with his love for his kids, even when they do terrible wrongs. And yet, he's also, you know, quite brutal. He's a murderer. He's an adulterer. So I think it's that humanness of him. You know, I love the Leonard Cohen song that talks about the holy and the broken. Hallelujah. And I think David really is both holy and broken.
You know, one of the reviewers of your book likened him to, of all people, Bill Clinton.
Ah, yes. Well, I can see where that reviewer was coming from, because I've been in the room with President Clinton, and there's something absolutely magnetic about him. Even if you go in there with not a high opinion of him, he has this ability to focus and this incredible laser-like charm. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that David had something like that, because it's fascinating. In the scripture, there's so many people who are said to love David. Jonathan loves David. Saul's daughter loves David. Everybody loves David. It's not much said about David loving other people.
That's very obvious as one reads the book. How did you put the story together? It had to be a novel, number one, because we know so little about him, correct?
I mean, that's right. Outside the pages of the Bible, we've got no written sources on him whatsoever. There's one stone inscription that's been uncovered that refers to him. And apart from that, we just really have that wonderful life story in the Bible itself.
There are so many gaps in the story, however. I mean, that must have been both fascinating and frustrating for you to try to fill those gaps.
Well, what's interesting, I think, is it's the first full life story we have from early childhood to extreme old age. He's the first man we meet in history, really, that we know over a full lifespan. So there is that wonderful arc of his life to work with. But what is lacking, I think, is the background of the other people and the point of view, particularly of the women. And there are a number of strong women in the story, but they're just sketches in the scriptures, so we don't really see things from their point of view. And for me, the most fascinating was to try and widen the viewfinder on what kind of lives they might have had and how their situation looked to them, rather than just how it affected David.
I've heard some of your other interviews, and this always comes up, so let's do that now, and that's Bathsheba. The story, I think, is relatively well known to most people. There have been movies made, David and Bathsheba, for instance. but your take on that, I think, is very interesting. Tell us what your take is on Bathsheba and David.
So I'm looking at it through the lens of somebody who spent a great many years as a correspondent in the Middle East. And when I was working as a newspaper reporter, my particular interest was the women of the region and how they negotiated their precarious lives, often in societies that gave them no power and put them in predicaments that were often very risky. So when I look at the Bathsheba story, the first thing I see is a young wife, because she doesn't have any children with her husband Uriah. She's left at home while Uriah is off fighting a war. I imagine her in a house with a lot of male servants. She's required by Jewish law to do a ritual purification once a month. She's looking for a private place to do it. They don't have bathrooms, okay? So where's she going to go? It's the middle of the night. She goes up to the roof where she thinks that she'll be private with her maid. Little does she know that next door in the palace, the king has insomnia, because it's the first time he hasn't gone to war with his own troops. He's feeling his age, and he's feeling maybe a bit less than a man. And he sees her. And the next thing you know, she hears a knock on the door, and she's demanded at the palace, does she have any choice in this? I don't think so.
You say she's raped.
I think it is a rape. If a woman has no choice, then what else would it be? So trying to see it through her eyes. And then, you know, it's pretty clear that David, you know, once his lust was satisfied, that was going to be the end of it as far as he was concerned. But the next thing you know, of course, she's pregnant and he has to cover this up because her husband's away. And the pregnancy will obviously expose that adultery has taken place. And when her husband can't be lured home to sleep with his wife so the child can be passed off as his, David has him killed.
An incredible part of the story. I mean, it's one of the things you read and you say, you know, as I said at the outset, you can't like David very much given how he handled that situation.
Well, but then, you know, he is confronted about it by his conscience, which is the prophet Nathan, who excoriates him for this behavior. And instead of having Nathan's head struck off, he listens and he accepts the chastisement, and then he tries to atone for it. And he has to pay a terrible cost for what he's done.
Sure. His children lost and his daughter lost. There was quite a price to pay. Let's talk about Nathan, Natan, he's called in the book. You use the Hebrew names, which quite frankly made it a little difficult for me getting started in the book until I caught on to who these people actually were.
That was intentional. I wanted it to be a little difficult. I didn't want people to come to the book with a preconception that they knew these guys, that they were the old bearded drawings in the Sunday school, you know, textbook. I wanted it to seem as strange as it is, because we are talking about Second Iron Age individuals. So I wanted to put a little distance and say, wait, maybe you don't know this guy as well as you think you do. And also, there's something I think quite beautiful about the Hebrew names, and why wouldn't we call them as they called themselves, you know? So Natan, or Nathan, is the prophet. He's the conscience of David. He's the one who turns up in the story to say, King, you suck. And, you know, I thought, what is the career path for that man? How do you get to be him? But then I found a couple of references in the Book of Chronicles referring to the Book of Nathan, in which the acts of David are told first and last. And yet, as you know, we don't have any Book of Nathan. It's lost. Yeah. And I thought, what kind of a book would that man, who is such a truth teller, what would he have told us that we don't know? So the secret chord is my attempt to imagine.
That's what I mean when I talk about the frustration. Is there a single gap, a single thing that you really, really wish you knew that is just nowhere to be found that would just satisfy some of that frustration?
Well, you know, I'd really like to know the nature of the relationship between David and Jonathan. Jonathan, of course, being the son of King Saul, and he's the heir to the throne of Israel. And then he meets the much younger David when David's emerged from the obscurity of being a shepherd boy in the boonies to suddenly arriving and turning the tide for the Hebrew tribes at the Battle of the Wadi Ila, when he famously kills Goliath. And then this friendship develops between David and Jonathan, which is described as a real love. Their souls were knit together, is the way the scriptures put it. And later, when Jonathan dies in battle, David's lament for him is one of the most beautiful eulogies ever composed. And it says, "My brother, Jonathan, your love to me was wonderful, more wonderful than the love of woman."
Well, so, many people have interpreted that, as you well know, to have been a homosexual relationship.
I think it sounds like a full relationship. Mm. Yeah, the love was so great that Jonathan finally gives up his inheritance. He's given David everything. He's given him his own clothes, his weapons, and finally he gives him the throne. He says, "You will be king and I will be second to you."
Mm-hmm. And yet there's no evidence of that kind of a relationship between David and any other men that we're aware of, certainly.
No. Yeah. But I don't think that was so unusual in that time. If you look at the cultures of the surrounding countries, there was often an acceptance of a physical relationship between an older man and a young boy, and that was considered to be a sort of a rite of passage, a good way to support a youth as he progresses into manhood, if he has a loving relationship with an older man.
And yet the people in today's modern world who are opposed to homosexual relationships say there's nothing to condone that kind of a relationship in the Bible.
Well, the Bible in several places actually excoriates those relationships. But, you know, so we all know that not everybody lives according to the precepts that are set down for them. So I think it's an open question, and I think it's one that we can't know the answer to. But you asked me which question I would ask, David. That's the one.
Yeah, well, that's certainly a fascinating one, no question about it. We're talking with Geraldine Brooks, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author whose latest book is The Secret Chord. That's what we're talking about. Geraldine Brooks, tonight at 7 o'clock, will be speaking about The Secret Chord at the Ethical Society on Clayton Road. That's happening at 7 o'clock. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. If you'd prefer to send us an email, do so at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet to STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with author Geraldine Brooks in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers will hold an open house public meeting today on the city's proposed North St. Louis site as the potential future home of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency West Campus. The Corps released its draft environmental impact statement recently on the 99-acre site at the intersection of North Jefferson and Cass Avenues, and we'll discuss it further later today. Democratic U.S. Senators Claire McCaskill of Missouri and Kirsten Gillibrand of New York will hold a press conference call later today challenging the National Fraternity and Sorority Association's support for the Safe Campus Act. The senators say the act would, quote, undermine and weaken the authority of colleges and universities to adjudicate incidents of sexual assault on their campuses. And an Illinois prison watchdog group is expected to issue a report later today that says the state has a cumbersome hiring system for its prisons and needs to streamline the process. The John Howard Association says the system results in jobs staying vacant too long. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with author Geraldine Brooks. Geraldine, what is the secret chord?
The secret chord is the music that only David knew how to play that was said to be particularly pleasing to God. And It's a line in a Leonard Cohen song, Hallelujah. They say there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. And to me, that's always been an intriguing part of his character, that he was this magnificent artist, this wonderful musician.
And that was inspired in part by your son, as I understand it.
That's right. When he was only 9 years old, my little boy turned to me and said, you know, I really want to play the harp. And I thought it was an unusual choice, but it was better than drums as far as I was concerned. So, but when I was watching him at his lesson, where his teacher had a magnificent concert instrument and it totally dwarfed him, and it made me think about that other boy harpist from the Bible, and, you know, who was also a warrior and a womanizer and all the other complicated things. And I went back to read his story, and that's when I discovered that he was really the first biography that we have that's told from first to last.
Was this the son you took with you to Israel and that part of the world to research the book?
No, that was my youngest son. Right. So my 9-year-old harpist is now a 19-year-old harpist, and he's off to college. So I took my youngest son the December before last. He was 10 years old. And I found that I love to exploit my kids in this way, because they make wonderful research assistants, because they see with fresh eyes. They ask questions that maybe wouldn't occur to us about things we take for granted. So because we don't have any written archives to delve into from David's time, I felt that the best research I could do would be kind of experiential, to go and do things that he might have done in the places associated with him. So my son and I ended up herding sheep one afternoon to see what you could learn about leadership, because it seemed interesting to me that so many of the Bible's leaders start off as shepherds. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, you know, what is it? What do you get out there on a hot, long day just looking at sheep? What do you learn? So I got some insights there, and then we climbed around the caves where David hid when he was an outlaw, when the king had turned against him. And my son was very fleet-footed, and he would take off ahead of me up the hill, and I would be laboring behind him, panting, an unfit middle-aged person. And I thought, yeah, I know what Saul was going through when David was always eluding him.
That's a fairly dangerous part of the world, to be traipsing around and doing research. Did you have any concerns about that?
Well, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Israel as a reporter, and in those days, my job was to go where it was the hottest, where the most dangerous things were happening. This was, by contrast, a much safer sort of a trip, because we weren't heading into conflict, but it was a quieter time too. One of the things we did was explore the archaeological excavations under the old city, and these, of course, are highly controversial, and it's a real flashpoint there now. So I think it would be much more difficult to do the kind of relaxed journey that we did at that time.
Well, I'll digress for a moment. As someone who is familiar with that part of the world, what do you make of what's going on there now, not only in Israel, but in that whole area, Syria, and the mess that has been created?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when authoritarian and sclerotic governments fall, you find out what exactly the heavy boot has been holding back. And I think none of us really, even those of us who spent a lot of time in Iraq, as I did under Saddam Hussein, and saw, you know, the appalling human rights abuses and real fear society he had created, I don't think any of us knew what sectarian forces he was holding back. And I think, you know, we were, in retrospect, very feckless in not having a plan for what happened the day after the war.
Same deal in Libya?
Libya, really? Absolutely. Syria is a little bit different, because there you've got your strongman ostensibly still in place, and yet the country is fracturing out underneath him. And sometimes we don't have a good choice. Sometimes you can't actually fix things the way we wish we could. And all you can do is try and be there to catch the people as they fall and alleviate human suffering.
Mm-hmm. Another example, of course, and I don't want to pursue this. We weren't really here to talk about the book. Tito and Yugoslavia, the same thing happened.
Yeah, Tito, exactly. We had no idea what he had his boot on. Right. And then we saw it.
Right. Okay, let's get back to the secret chord. I'm fascinated by Nathan and the fact that David killed his father. And it seems almost unrealistic to me that Nathan, therefore, would follow David and go willingly into his camp and serve him for the rest of his life.
I don't know that Nathan feels that he has a choice, because Nathan, in his own mind, believes he's being directed. He, after his father's death, it's his first experience of prophecy. And so because Nathan is the narrator of this book, we only understand his visions from his point of view. But is he really hearing the voice of the divine, or does he only believe he is? So to leave that question slightly open to the reader to decide whether he's a reliable narrator or not, I've had some of the other characters, the more pragmatic people, the generals like Yoav and Avner, cast doubt. They don't believe it. You know, they think he's, you know, just playing for a position of power and that he has these visions conveniently to keep him at David's side. But I felt that for Nathan himself, once he has had his first experience of prophecy, he has no choice but to be beside David, whether he likes the man or not. That is his destiny.
Do we know more about Nathan than we do about David?
No, we don't know. We know much less about Nathan. He's a very elusive figure. He's the guy who castigates the king, and then he's the guy who's there at the end game when David is lying close to death, and one of the younger sons, who's the eldest surviving at that point, because the two eldest have, you know, basically one of them's murdered the other, and the other's been killed by Yoav, and so the next in line decides to seize the throne while his father's still alive, and it's Nathan and Bathsheba, interestingly to me, who are there trying to prevent that happening and making sure that it's Bathsheba's son, Solomon, who we know went on to go down in history as a byword for wisdom and good governance. So Nathan is a power player in the end. And interestingly, so is Bathsheba. So from her unpromising beginning, she has managed to forge a relationship with the king and a place in the court that gives her this private power that she wields at the end.
Yeah. Nathan said to David early on that he would rule or reign forever. What do you take that to mean? There are several interpretations of that, as I understand it.
Well, what millions have taken it to mean is that when it says that his kingdom will endure forever, that's the kingdom of Christ, because Jesus, of course, in the New Testament is a descendant of David, and that's why Mary and Joseph find themselves so inconveniently situated in Bethlehem when he is born, because they've been required to go there because there's a census of all the descendants of David being carried out. And it's fascinating to think about Mary and Joseph and them looking back to David. It's already 1,000 years, so he's already an unimaginably distant figure to them.
Right. And the with regard to the lineage, it was Joseph who was in the line, if you will, not the line of succession,
but
in the family
and
line.
And Mary.
Both of them were? Mm. Well, I missed that somehow. So there's pretty much a consensus then that that's what...
That's what the prophecy has been interpreted to mean.
Right, right. How did this research and this work on this book change you?
I think that every book changes you a little bit. I think it's made me a little bit more in love with biblical Hebrew. I used to be a great admirer of the literary qualities of the King James Bible. Mm-hmm. But so the King James Bible is like a Corinthian column. It's very decorative. It's very florid and elaborated. And when you get back to the biblical Hebrew, it's completely different. It's very austere. It's very unadorned, but it has a great beauty to me. So it's the beauty of, if you like, an Ionic column, very straight lined and less is more. And so I think as a writer, it's been interesting to me to look at how a story can be told two ways. Mm-hmm. And I really think that we can learn a lot from the beauty of the austerity.
In reading the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament, do you look at it as history, real history, I mean accurate history, or do you look at it as myth, legend, lore?
I think it shimmers somewhere on the line between the two. I think, you know, you have to tie yourself into a pretzel to take it as absolute history because there's so many things in it that are ahistoric and out of the right time period and just, you know, cannot be empirically squared away. But did David live? I think he did, because nobody would make up somebody this flawed as their national hero. So I think that somebody very much like him lived, and something very similar to the events conveyed probably happened. We can't know for sure.
I wonder why he would show up in various places in the Bible, widely separated places.
I think because different parts of the scripture, you know, were pieced together at different periods of time. You know, there's a tremendous amount of scholarship on this about author A and author B and the court historian and whose accounts, you know, looking at it stylistically, who wrote what and when, looking at some of the, you know, the tells in the text itself about what was going on, the things that they reference. And, you know, I don't pretend to be an expert on that, but I think that the fact that he shows up in different accounts probably means that the people needed different versions at different times, and then at some point it was all compiled, but it wasn't tightly edited, so people didn't want to destroy any part of these sacred texts.
Let's talk for a moment about the women. We've talked about Bathsheba. Most of the women that you bring into the book are very strong women, as you mentioned a little while ago. We don't know necessarily that they were, but you made them strong.
What we have, these brief sketches of them indicate that. All of them are expressing a lot of agency for women of that period. When you consider that most women in the Old Testament, we don't even hear their name, like Lot's wife. Gladys? Faye?
Probably not.
Noah's wife. You know, they don't even get a name, whereas the women in David's story actually do things. You know, so Abigail, who becomes his wife, meets him under very inauspicious circumstances. He's about to conduct a raid on her husband's, you know, flocks and family, and she forestalls it because she understands what the risks are better than her husband does, and so she circumvents the raid, and David is so impressed by her canniness that when her husband dies, he asks her to marry him. And Michal, the daughter of King Saul, also expresses agency. It's she who says that she loves David and she wants this marriage, even though the father at that point is a little bit ambivalent about it. And I have to say, it reminded me of a very strange afternoon I spent with Ayatollah Khomeini's widow at their house in northern Tehran when I was a news correspondent. And she was telling me the story of how she came to be married to Khomeini. And it was not a sure thing. When young Ruhollah came to her father seeking her hand, he was an impoverished religious student whose prospects weren't very good, and her father wasn't inclined to accept him. But little Hadija, who was then a very young girl, was allowed to go in fully covered in her chador and give tea to this young man. And she liked the look of him. And so when she realized her father was against the match, she had a dream that night that she saw Ruhollah sitting with all the great prophets of Islam as an equal. And so the next day she told her father this dream. And her father, I guess, was superstitious, and so he said she could marry him. And I thought about her as I thought about Michal maneuvering her father's opinion so that she could get married to David.
How much do you think the role of women has really changed in that part of the world?
I think, you know, tragically, it is in a kind of a stasis. I mean, the first book I ever wrote was Nine Parts of Desire, about women in the Middle East and Muslim world, where at that point I'd spent 6 years. And it was in many places quite bleak in terms of what their rights and protections were and what their freedoms were to pursue any kind of destiny that wasn't strictly domestic. And I think in the years since, instead of that book being completely irrelevant now and things moving on, when we see, you know, what ISIS requires of women, when we see what the Taliban requires, where they're shooting girls for wanting to learn, where they're, you know, killing teachers, we're really going backwards, not forwards. Yeah.
That's why I asked the question. It's yes, it seems that's the case. What's your next project, Geraldine Brooke?
So it's a little bit more recent. It's another historical novel, and it's about a wonderful horse who was quite renowned in the 1860s, and about what happened to that horse during the Civil War, and a missing work of art that has a connection to the birth of abstract expressionism in New York in the 1940s. So it will be a braided narrative about a horse and a painting.
Okay, well, I think we'll just wait. It's not going to be out next week.
That is, I'm afraid, all too true.
All right, well, we'll certainly look forward to it. As this book that we've just been talking about, The Secret Court, is a wonderful read. I recommend it just because I enjoyed it so much. I hope other people will take that advice from me. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I'll remind folks that Geraldine Brooks will be discussing her book, The Secret Court, at 7 o'clock tonight at the Ethical Society on Clayton Road. Again, thank you for being with us. Coming up, we're going to transition here because we're going to be talking about haunted houses, of all things. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.